Wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
Down in the new basement studios by the lake. As it's summertime, I feel like we haven't been together for a while.
Well, we did. You know, you did the greatest hits or... That's
true, yeah. Well, but we haven't
sat... You don't call it greatest hits. What do we call it?
Best of.
Best of, yes. Right. So that would have been 2 weeks ago. And anybody who wants a nice sampling can go back there. You know, we called out all the boring parts.
Yes.
You know, for the most exciting parts.
I always worry that the first show after a best of show... suddenly feels like, oh, this isn't as exciting it's as like the best stuff.
You're starting at the low level now, yeah. And you're working up from there instead of peak performance. This is...
Anyway, as it's summertime, we haven't been together recording for a while, so we have our in-tray full of topics that we are going to attack.
Right. Our classic thing is, as we see things, we're sending each other emails. Yep. How about this? And it goes into a folder, and then you go, hey, we haven't really picked a formal topic for this week, so what are we going to do? I guess we'll do all those things we have in the inbox.
Do you want to talk about someone who asked you about,
topics? Well, yeah, so I was going to say,
one of our fans, a new fan.
Not
a fan.
Not listening. I mean, just knows of the podcast. I'm going to take the opportunity after we have this discussion now, I will tell her that, you know, we talked about you on the podcast, so now she'll be forced to listen.
At least once,
I'm going to call her my office neighbor.
Office neighbor.
Yeah, so just somebody who's a couple offices down from me, down the hall, who knows I do the podcast, said, oh, what are you doing on your podcast this week? And I was like, well, it's just going to be all over the map. You know,
stuff.
And sort of screwed up her face to say, well, what do you mean? You have to have like a theme or a thing. And I had to explain that we don't.
We don't. That's something, and it is true.
We can try to thread a theme through.
I remember when we first registered, all those years ago, when we first registered our podcast, you register it on the different servers and on iTunes, right. And they ask you to tag it up with what you think
I constantly get the question from people like, oh, what is your podcast about? I'm like, it's about whatever we want to.
Yeah,
be
we're kind of.
About.
I think we're kind of a throwback.
Yeah,
we're not specialists. Anyone can join. Yeah. So if this is not a podcast just about disc brakes on your car, do you know what I mean? Like there is this notion that podcasts are all niche things, but we're actually not.
So it's interesting. The podcast, you know, these various networks have been arisen. People would come up with a big podcast, and then they start spinning things off. So the 99% Visible podcast, which I've mentioned before, becomes the anchor for, I forget what their network is, but they're constantly pushing other podcasts, you know, on different topics. It's like you took a TV show and it became a network. And, you know, like the Bill Simmons, you know, the sports guy, formerly of ESPN, formerly of Grantland, now has The Ringer. He started with he was just doing a podcast by himself, and then people would do another one. And well, now you go, and I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know if they're making more money or they're just more into it. But The Ringer has more podcasts than articles at this point. And some of them are very good, but the other part of me said, I'm like, you can't, if you guys crank out 15 podcasts in a week, you know, I'm not listening to all that. I don't, you know, have that many hours. I don't watch a single TV station, which I guess, you know, we should all come to assume, well, that's the way TV works. You don't watch every single show on a network. But I do think they overestimate what they're going to do to their own brand by adding in a new podcast every 2 days.
What's funny, while I was away on vacation, because I've been on vacation, which is why you all got a best of podcast, which is why we hadn't done one live per se. This was an article that I actually didn't send you because, as you've explained, we send each other articles for things to talk about. And it actually said that there are so many podcasts out there now that apparently there is a thing where you listen to as much as you can, but at times two speed.
Oh, yeah. No, that's
did you read the article?
I didn't read it, but I mean, I do know it's a setting on my podcast software. I don't use does iTunes let you do that? I don't know.
I don't know.
I use this thing called Pocket Cast for my
podcast. Yes, but iTunes does.
Okay.
iTunes,
so I've done, and you can do it where, like, it will soak up any gaps. Like, it'll do a thing where basically it knows that there's a low, and it'll just kind of take up that space and kind of jam everything together closer. You can do it where it's like, you can turn a little dial so you can go 1.5 speed.
That's
one,
right.
Quarter speed, 2 speed, and things like that. And it, you know, it doesn't make you sound like a chipmunk because the technology now can speed it up without changing the tone.
Yeah.
It just has everybody talking faster like this, like, and that must be the way you consume your materials.
When I read the
article. You also slow it down if you're not very bright.
Yeah. I mean, when I read the article, there was a part of me that was slightly offended. Like, ooh, No, actually, my time is worth more than you speeding it up.
Oh, but I thought now, you were going to say, like, it manipulates your timing.
Yeah, but now, actually, I don't get out there. If you listen, I don't care how fast you listen. Just listen. It doesn't bother me.
It can be a solution for some of the folks who complain that it's too long.
Yes.
We've always said, we'll take a break halfway through. We could just say, we'll just play at twice speed. You'll be done with us in a half an hour.
So all you out there, and you know who you are, that have complained the show's too long, we'll just listen at half speed.
No,
Talking of podcasts, this was the first related story. That a couple of weeks ago, Apple announced that they were killing the iPod.
The iPod gone, right? You know, I pulled it up here somewhere.
They were specifically killing it.
A lot of your articles are British papers, so Guardian, which is now asking me to donate money to them because they don't
do a paywall.
For things, yeah. They're basically saying, hey, all the iPods except for the iPod, what do they call it, Touch. It basically looks like an iPhone.
Looks like an iPhone, yes.
Just that you can't make calls with it.
It's
more of like a small internet device. It's more like a tiny iPad.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
But all the iPods that were originally designed for music, including the ones with little dials and the little ones that didn't have any screen at all.
Which I do have.
Nanos and
Shuffles.
All done. Not into that anymore. And considering, of course, that is where the word podcast comes from.
Yeah. Podcasts originated with the notion of your MP3 player device that you could download it from the computer. Yeah. And you could listen to it as you walk around. But it would appear that the smartphone.
Now we're just going to be phone casts or something.
Has killed the device. We're old school. I must say, and I'm going to hit you now with a question. Where do you think the iPod will rank in terms of entertainment technology? And I'm not going to ask you now. I'm going to sort of give you an example to help you with your answer. I always think that ultimately the LP, the record, is always going to go out there as this was a major moment in how sound was delivered to the listener.
You said LP, but you really mean all records, generally.
Well, no, I mean the pressed wax plastic record. I mean, what I'm saying is that people always go, well, you know, the cassette tape. People might argue that the Walkman was big. Do you know what I mean? I'm just wondering
you can pretty easily say.
I mean, iPod was the first device your music was just there. You didn't buy a separate piece of, whether it was a mini disc or a laser disc or a CD or a cassette tape.
But you did buy something. So that's
sure.
It is clearly a transition item because you went from buying albums to buying 8-tracks to buying cassettes to buying CDs to buying something where now you didn't have it physically. And then the next step is, well, you don't buy it at all. You just rent
you
it.
Borrow
you
borrow it.
Streamed, you know. It's very important as a transition element, but the CD, I think, was more revolutionary in terms of it was the first digital music. Like, it's no longer an analog thing. It was a new way of delivering music that had no problems, no scratches, no, you know, junk. Oh, it skips when you...
So you're saying CD is more important?
I think so.
Okay, I'm going to go with iPod.
There'll be some retrospective of the types of music. And at that point, I mean, what comes next after streaming?
I will have won, or you will have won. We just don't know when we'll be able to cash in. I don't know. I do feel you're right. I do agree with you to an extent that the CD perhaps is ultimately the most important device in terms of how music is delivered. But I do think the iPod combined... I mentioned the Walkman. The iPod... I remember having a portable CD player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I built a little shelf for my car, for the old car that didn't have a CD player before it did, where you could pop open the top of the portable CD player.
I don't know. It's interesting.
You got to be careful then, because if you got on a bumpy road, it would skip.
Well, there you go, see? So anyway, I'm actually a little bit sad about the demise of the iPod, because I am still, as is often, I don't think this is not news to our fans, I am a late adopter of technology.
Yeah, you hold on to it until it shatters into a million pieces.
I've still
rubber bands around your phones. And
I've still got it.
I've seen your iPad
still,
has like duct tape along the edges.
Because I don't like spending money on these things. I still use my iPod, but I leave it in the car all the time. It's my way of, because I don't like plugging in my phone. It's weird. I've always regarded these things as different devices, yet ultimately the future is you just have one device
that
does everything,
yeah,
including your washing.
I mean, when I think about it, actually, you know, even though I do the Spotify, all the thing, I don't generally stream the music from, like, the phone system. You know, it's not like I'm driving around using up my data to play music. I download it to the phone through Spotify or through Google Play Music or something like that. So in a sense, I'm still handling the music in more of almost like an iPod way.
I'm going slightly off order of topics here, but you were talking to me before the show about how you've been watching Phish concerts online. You know, a couple where you've sort of paid a fee and then it streams.
They have one
in
that was
you can
free,
sit and watch
and
it.
Then generally they're 20 or 25 bucks each, and you can webcast them.
Yeah.
So what they do is all their concerts now, you can watch live at the time, HD signal, super high fidelity. You just plug in a computer. You can actually, if anybody wants to sample it, and the next time I think they're doing concerts are Labor Day weekend, if you're interested. The first song of each set, they just recently did 13 nights at Madison Square Garden.
Okay.
And first song of each set, they would put on a YouTube live broadcast. So you could watch a song. Like, so one time the song was a 20-minute long song, so you got like a free live show basically there. Other times they'd be like 2-minute songs and you really weren't getting you weren't paying anything, but you weren't getting that much worth. That's a nice dribble right there.
Yeah.
The other member of the household was out of town, I was like, well, I don't really have anything else to do, so I'm going to put it on my big 70-inch, you know, HD TV, and we have, you know, not many people have this anymore, but we have a stereo system with, you know, the full set of speakers and surround speakers
connected
to the TV, so you can blast it like it's a real concert, turn the lights down, I got a refrigerator right in the next room over from there, and so watch the whole concert from downstairs.
So my question for you then, with that in mind, as we get out of iPods, do you still buy music to own? Or are you at the state now where you are streaming stuff, whether it be concerts? Like you paid for the Phish concert.
Yeah.
You watched it, one-time thing.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, what did you say it was, $20?
Yeah.
I'll still go and spend $20 in a month on music.
Are you buying CDs or are you buying iTunes?
No, I'm buying iTunes, but I still buy it and own it.
Yeah, see, if you're paying $20 a month.
Well, I'm just saying, throwing out a number.
Oh,
like, songs are $1.29, but what I'm saying is I won't think twice about sitting at a computer one night and buying 6 songs and spending $10, and Bob's your uncle.
Yeah.
No, because my question for you is,
there's like those live shows you can then buy, because those aren't really streamed because they're just hosted at the Phish website. Those things I'll buy, but very rarely.
So let me ask you.
But there's no, like, if you forget about whether $20 is a rough estimate, but if you're buying a certain number of songs, if you spend $10 a month on music, buying music, there's no reason not to have, well, that's not true. I was going to say, there's no reason not to just pay for Spotify and have it for $10 a month. I mean, the catch is you're always tied to that.
Yeah.
At some point, because anytime I would get a hankering to get an album, see, I used to do that where I would get it on my phone, but I also would go on Amazon and I'd buy the CD because I'd say, okay, I want to have that CD for whatever formats I'm going to use it on. But at some point, now I'm reading the newspaper. Oh, look, there's this band came out with an album or something like that. Well, I go, I'm sitting there right there. I turn it on the phone. I put it on Spotify. I download it. I'm like, well, now what reason do I have to go buy it? I'm going to listen to it in my car. Maybe if I decided I loved it a ton, maybe I'd go buy it. But then at that point, I go, why do I buy it? It's right here.
Let me ask you about, we're not doing a thing about Phish, but the Phish concert, when you pay for that, is it a one-time experience or can you go in and re-watch it?
I looked and it does say that I can watch it. If it's anything like the music downloads they do from there, there's a window. Like they go, okay, watch it on demand whenever you want, but they can't host it for 5 years and be constantly spitting out these concerts over their system just because I think it would just take up too much bandwidth or, you know, they just don't want to have to monitor that much stuff. But I'll find out. I'll let you know if I cut it off.
All right. So let's get on with the topics.
Yeah, right,
we were just getting in there.
Yeah.
Can't decide. If you're out there listening, this might be a moment to go to double speed.
Yeah, right.
All right. So we had some feedback from one of our fans. A senior science advisor of the pod.
Yeah, which I did find out, I think, a couple of episodes, and I think even in the greatest of, I was having a trouble remembering.
He is. Yeah.
No, that's his realist title. I found out. That's his actual title.
I understand that's his title, but is that our title?
Oh, yeah,
for him?
Okay, it's perfect. Right. That was the whole joke. He has this new title. It's perfect for being senior scientist, sort of like freelance scientist. It started with, I had sent him an article, and he sent something back that showed his connection. So there was an article in the Washington Post, and and it was really about a DC thing, saying DC's only endangered species is shy and sightless, but it's having a moment, and it's this little tiny shrimp. It's over in the Rock Creek Park. Apparently, okay. It's literally the only place on the globe it is. Like, really? I guess there are little animals like this that are, you know, only in very small areas. You know,
that's interesting.
They can't range around. It's like 5 millimeters big and stuff like that. But the point of the article wasn't about that, other than the fact they were trying to keep track of it, but how they were doing it, which is, rather than trying to find the little animals everywhere, they just scooped up large amounts of water or sand or whatever it was and looked for the DNA. Because now DNA review for DNA and checking and sequencing is so much easier than it was when it first came along, that you can figure out if the animal's around without ever seeing the animal by looking for the DNA. And then they sort of, from there, you know, they're trying to do some environmental checking and things like that. But the gist of it is, and that's what I thought was the interesting part, is you don't even got to go look for the little tiny animal. You just need to look for the signs of the little tiny animal, in the sense of it sheds some, you know, organic material.
Well, to be fair, it's not like tagging polar bears or sharks that are big things. And yeah, we can label them and we can follow. I mean, I think they do this all the time with fish, that they tag them up. And then they follow it on the tracker, right. And they can chase its habits. But you're right, for something that's tiny, you can't physically do that.
Yeah,
you know. So using the DNA technology is the way to go.
So, but what's interesting? So I send that to.
Well, they got that from the James Bond film.
What's funny is, we're going to come back to people and DNA things in a second, but the. So I send that. I oftentimes will send articles to the senior scientists that come from the Post. But the thing is, he subscribes to so many like more in-depth scientific
proper
things.
Science
and
stuff,
we've talked before, like when the Washington Post runs an article about something science,
they really dumb it down.
It's like 10%.
They really dumb it down.
You know, things that are theories suddenly become facts. It's much more simply. So whenever I send that to him, I'm like, well, listen, I'm not trying to advise you on the science, but it turns around, he comes back and he says. So he's up in New England, and his day job when he's not advising the pod is working mostly on water flow, water issues up in New England.
Yeah.
And it's very
specific. So this is right up his...
Right. So he mentions in response, so he's actually involved in this stuff, that there's a researcher up there who is asking them to collect samples from the streams, and then this research woman, she sorts out all the DNA in there to try to figure out everything that's in there and try to get the... You could get like a picture of everything that lives in a river or a stream based on the DNA you cull out of there without ever having to actually find the actual animals. Like, you just basically go through the whole thing. So, you know, they're doing some interesting work around.
What does the DNA stress come
proteins
from?
Proteins and things. Well, it's just like off their bodies, I guess. Yeah.
And like when they feed on stuff. I mean, even if you're 5 millimeters, you're still having a good chew of something.
Yeah, I guess
they've all got mouths, haven't they? Well, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, some of them just sort of absorb things osmotically or something like that. But
so that's what I'm saying.
And he mentioned something about heat stress proteins that give you an indication of their health, which I guess if an animal is under some duress or something like that, maybe it spits out different types of proteins that you can then check.
He's sweating more.
But
I get that when I'm under pressure.
But bringing that back to people, now I haven't done any research on this, and this would be a perfect one for CSI Dan. I'll have to check in with him and see if they like people are doing this. But I have heard talk that's the next wave, and like it's not, you know, obviously the police can check DNA, but they're usually checking DNA like from an assault or blood things or something like that. But they're basically saying that the next wave of that stuff is being able to go into a room
and just troll
and figure out if a person was there.
You're basically just trolling for DNA. And again, I was about to say the CSI people. The people searching for the organisms have just taken what CSI people do. They've taken that principle, but in a strange way, they actually haven't.
They're going broader. Like,
they're going broader.
They're not like, let's look at a footprint and figure out whose DNA is in the footprint.
They're just like, they're looking at
let's see what's around. Like, just send a big net out. And so that's what I've heard. Between that and they talk about people's individual biomes, and everybody has a different mixture of bacterias on them.
Oh, yeah.
Almost like a fingerprint. And they kind of persist with you for life, basically, and nobody's is the same.
Really. Yeah.
Those are one of those things where they can now go into like a room and scoop everything up and be like, okay, there's this stuff. That means it's likely that somebody was here, kind of thing. So that's, you know, we always worry about cameras being everywhere and, you know, your phone tracks you everywhere you go. But
Alexa,
even if we get past, Home. If we get past all that stuff, like if we were somehow anonymized that stuff, 100 years from now, nobody, like, you know, what happens when now, instead of, think of this, I'm going off the top of my head.
No, dude.
If instead of the police, Amazon installs like sniffers basically in train stations or someplace else where people come through, and they basically just collect up and they can figure out who was there and all that.
I only say this because I'm currently watching a show on TV, and it's one of those, you know, it's like a murder mystery serial, and part of it is that the police are trying to round up suspects, and they're having people, they're swabbing them for their DNA.
You're right. Yeah, now if you don't swab them,
but that's what I'm saying.
Like, as they go by, you check them.
While right now the technology is hunting for small shrimp-like people in one beasts in one area, the legality of this is actually quite interesting. Because I'm not actually consenting for you to come in the room and just troll it for my DNA, and yet, you know, so that's
like
what I'm saying.
Current state of the law would probably say that you have no right, other than being in a room that would be private, but like if you're in a public space, you have no right. Like, it's a thing you left behind. If you left behind your license on the floor, you can't claim that people, there's a privacy, you know.
No, but I would imagine it. In a weird way, it comes back to access to the property, doesn't it?
But that's, it's one of those areas where as people get more involved in this, you might see the, you know, we don't have to have all these principles be immutable. We could basically say, listen, because of what we can do now, we're going to say the sphere of privacy covers some other things that we would not conventionally think of covering right now.
All right, so there you go. That's your DNA update. Where are we going next? Do we have more science?
Well, I mean,
or are we going to deliveries?
Do you count protection of the Earth as science?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so you sent this article out of the USA Today. Always, you know, the
it was covered on many websites.
Yeah, I'm gonna guess.
And I only picked this one just so that it wasn't just. Can I stop for a moment there? Because you did say earlier, obviously, I use the Guardian website a lot. You use the Washington Post website a lot. You commented at the start of the show, the Guardian's a little bit slower because they always want some sort of one-time payment.
Yeah, meaning the website, not meaning their personal.
You send me all the Washington Post stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly on my limit of free articles. And I'm actually at the point now where I think they're no longer doing that. Like, you have to digitally subscribe, I think, for the Post. I'm not sure.
They're pushing it. Are you not, you know?
So now I just sign in via Amazon, and I'm going to run with that because it's the same owner. Yeah. I'm going to run with that until they start hitting me up. And then in the future.
Do you have Amazon Prime?
Yes.
I think you get.
Do I get the Post for free
with
that?
Post because of the Bezos connection or something. Because
if not, the moment's going to come when you're going to send me something from the Post that I'm going to go, I can't read that. You're going to have to carry this topic on your own.
It used to be, at least. If you had a digital subscription to the Post, you could actually give another person a sign into it. Like, it wasn't limited. Like, they were trying to, I don't know if that was just because they were trying to spread it at the time or if it's still the case. And I've offered up our subscription to folks who are out of town who I knew would like the Post and say, hey, listen, if you want, you can just use ours. And nobody's taken me up, so I might just have to give it to you.
All right. Then, no, I can live with that. So anyway, I sent it from USA Today just to use a different originator.
NASA.
But basically, NASA have been advertising a job that I think pays six figures, where you're basically in charge.
Planetary Protection Officer.
That's right.
That's the title. And according to USA Today, the salary, probably depending upon your experience in protecting planets, is between $124,000 and $187,000 per year.
I was thinking of applying.
Yeah. Well,
because there's
a picture in the middle article of basically a kid's handwriting. I can't figure. They put it on a space backdrop.
So some kid did write in. Yeah.
My name is Jack Davis, and I would like to apply for the Planetary Protection Officer job. I may be nine, but I can't see the rest of the thing. But
I would go for that job.
Like the
I'm exactly the sort of person.
Even if you go there, it links to the actual job listing, which I don't want to hit because I'm afraid I won't get to the website in time. But it does say candidates must have a quote advanced knowledge of planetary protection, experience in overseeing nationally significant space programs, have demonstrated quote skills in diplomacy that resulted in a win-win solutions during extremely difficult and complex multilateral discussion.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but all I know is I'm completely paranoid about aliens. I don't trust any of them. I'm exactly the person you want, you know, to paraphrase Jack Nicholson, standing on that wall.
Yeah.
Exactly the person.
You have to have a secret clearance, so that means you've got to go through a background check.
Okay. I can deal with
that. But the starting point was you're protecting from, quote, organic constituent and biological contamination. So maybe at some level it's not necessarily about big aliens. So that's, you know, if it falls in your thing, their immediate concern is more like, you know, a virus gets on there. Very
this is
Prometheus why, slash yes, yeah, alien yeah. slash
this is why you need senior science advisor's DNA tracking thing.
Yes, maybe the senior science advisor
should. This is what we should be using that technology for. Just get it out there in case aliens have been invading us at a nano level.
Assuming they have DNA.
Ooh, yeah. Well, isn't it a building block of life?
That's the assumption.
And that's
there's a very long article you sent where we're not going to get into, which is about the whole effort of like scanning the stars for intelligence.
Yeah, with a big telescope. Now, I remember why I sent it to you, because I was going to make fun of it. I thought it was very... My biggest thing about aliens is the fact that we always presume that at some level we will be able to quantify them. And what I mean by that is they will be physical beings that we can clearly go, it's alive, but it doesn't look like us. My whole point about aliens, and this is now my pitch for this job, aliens could be working on all kinds of different levels.
Yeah, well, that's...
On an ESP level.
So the gist of that article was talking about the fact that they're filtering out planets based on being not too hot, not too cold, kind of thing like that.
And that was my, but that was my thing.
And I'm like...
That was my assumption. The aliens are all going to be like us? No.
I know that's not a super... it's less superficial than that. Yeah. But you're right at some level, which is...
I thought that this is why...
You're always right at some levels.
Yeah. I am right.
And not at this right level, at all levels.
At a DNA level, I'm correct.
But the... if you looked at that at first, you'd say, oh, they're being so human-centric or... Earth-centric and thinking that that's what life is going to be. And it's not totally good. I mean, the people who think that have done like a deeper analysis of like the origins of life in the first place, that how do you get these things together to now kind of...
But here's
it's all frozen, basically. Like, let me tell you, if it's all frozen, how the heck do you get... chemistry doesn't happen, when things are frozen. They just stay where they are. If it's so hot that everything bakes away, you can't ever get anything to stay because radiation blows it all away. So, yeah, sure, fine, there's a range there. But, that just shows our brains are not...
But this is my point.
I saw Arrival. Those things were like gaseous cephalopods.
I'm pitching a what? Isn't that a dinosaur? Isn't that the dinosaur like that only eats vegetables? A cephalopod or something?
Cephalopod.
Yeah. Cephalopod. All I'm saying is the correct semaphore. Phrase. The correct phrase is life as we know it.
Doing semaphore.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the aliens might be flagging us down. Who knows?
So, anyway, if you're interested, and you can't find the link to the article, the job offering, let us know and we'll link you in.
Well, because the big eclipse is coming up too, which...
Yes, right.
And that's in my mind, that went along cover. With the aliens, yeah.
Didn't we have something... There was something new on asteroids. I don't want to get back into the asteroids, no.
But we're always aware. Yeah, I'm going to put like that on
person,
my resume.
This person seems to be organic focused. They need a separate position for asteroids, which would be inorganic attacks.
Or you need someone like me who's... I've got experience in all of it. I'm paranoid about any kind of alien attack.
Presumably the asteroids would be
inorganic. Asteroids, anyway. ESP aliens, invisible aliens, aliens that look like us. I'm ready for all of it.
There you go.
Aliens scare the crap out of me.
Transform aliens that look like Mack trucks.
That still scares me.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've seen that Stephen King... I always forget what it's called. What's the Stephen King movie with Emilio Estevez?
Oh, yeah. Maximum Overdrive.
Maximum Overdrive. That was the trucks.
Well, I was thinking of Transformers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But isn't there a new Stephen King thing coming out? It...
No, there's the Dark Tower that bombed, or is currently
there's
in
another
the process
new thing coming out.
Oh, there
I think
is
it's a series. It's going to be a series.
Oh no, you're right. Yes, I think it's it.
That looked pretty serious and dark, like not a little bit goofy. Which Dark Tower looked a little goofy.
Anyway, the big eclipse is coming up.
Yes, won't be total here. It's going to be about 85% here in Washington D.C.,
which means it's going to be pretty dark.
It's basically I think it's the first. It's like the first total eclipse that's going to traverse the nation, United States, that being, in like 100 years.
I was about to say, I do not remember anything like this in my lifetime.
So you're not 100 years old.
No,
you're indeterminate middle age.
We're of indeterminate middle age, and that's, but still, that's a long time.
But it's literally starting on the West Coast and going across, coming off, it kind of makes an arc from up in the Washington area down to Charlotte, down to Charleston, North Carolina, that area.
And of course, it's an eclipse where the moon goes in front of the sun.
Right.
Well, I'm just pointing it out for people, because not everyone knows. I mean, I get them confused.
Solar eclipse. It's eclipsing the sun.
So that's a solar eclipse.
As opposed to a lunar eclipse.
Which is where the moon just disappears for 20
years. But it is different. Like, so, I've learned a bunch about these eclipses recently. There are solar eclipses that are total solar eclipses.
Yep.
And then there are ones that are called annular solar eclipses, which are like the distances can be such that when the moon passes in front of the sun, on sometimes it doesn't completely obscure the sun. Like, you know, the picture, like the how big something looks in your field of view. The moon is smaller, and so those are the ones you get, you know, like it won't totally block out the sun. Even when it's dead straight lined up with it, there'll still be a big ring of sun around it, so you can't see it.
Is
so
that this one?
No, this is a total.
So this, so this is where the total, moon is like, huge. Yeah, like
If you're in the total area, the sun will be completely blocked, and you'll be able to see all that cool corona stuff around the outside. Not the beer, but the
What day is it?
The 21st of August.
So that's a Monday.
Yep.
Yeah.
So anybody who's got appointments.
I'm quite excited.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the big thing they say is a total solar eclipse, which we won't get because we're only 85%.
No, but still 85%.
It's like such a different thing. Do you have the protective glasses?
No.
Well, you're not going to be able to look at it.
I've got sunglasses.
No, you'll go blind.
What's the one with the pinhole camera?
That's what you do with it.
Yeah.
I actually have about 10 pairs of glasses upstairs if you want a pair.
I will do so, yeah. How are they different from sunglasses?
Oh, they completely block things out. Like, you can't, if you put up a pair of the eclipse glasses, if you put, like, the LED from your phone, that's about the only thing you can see through it. Like, you can't see TVs or lamps or anything like that.
I need them. And give them to me today, because then I can list it on my resume to NASA. Also own my own super protective glass, because you're going to need them if you're involved with aliens in any which way.
There's a bit of a run on them. So if anybody is looking for them, one of the things that was
we've
out
gone
there,
for sale,
fakes. Like, and people could, like, go blind if you don't have the certified set of them from certain companies.
Trust the knockoff industry to get involved in this.
Well, suddenly everybody's paying, you know, a buck a pair for these.
How long will the event last if you are in the area?
So it's interesting. Some parts of it are much faster than I thought, and some parts are much slower. So, like, just sitting here, the amount of time from when the moon starts to go across the sun to when it's done, it's a solid 2.5 hours.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a long time of going across the thing. But it's moment of peak, like when you're a place where it's a total eclipse, it's only like a few minutes.
Oh, wow.
So, like, it's a bunch of hours with just a few minutes of the thing being completely skewered, and then it goes the other way. And it makes its way across the nation from that west coast to the east coast in about 90 minutes. Like, if you picture the total solar eclipse going across, it goes like super fast.
Have you ever seen Independence Day, the first one, and the big spaceships come and they block out the light?
Yeah.
This is what this could be like. Are you listening, NASA? I'm spending this whole show now attempting to show NASA should be given the alien job.
You're going to submit this as a part of your application?
What? Why not?
Yeah.
The aliens aren't going to announce their presence on paper. They could be doing it. Who knows?
So if you're really into it, you can get filters for your cameras and for binoculars and all that stuff, so you could look at things bigger, too.
So if the event start to finish last 2.5 hours, let's just say where we are on sort of the latitude or longitude on the planet, does that mean that there will be a noticeable difference in light for 2.5 hours?
No, because it's just starting to obscure. It's going to get progressively darker, but it will be.
What happens if it's a cloudy day? Are we locked out completely?
It'll get darker, right? It'll get darker because the sun will be, you know, blocked, but you won't like see a thing up there.
All right.
So, well, one of the things, like, people were getting things for
I'm
their
glad
cameras.
They set this up.
You
for
know,
August.
Any, like, there doesn't seem any value. This is one of those things that taking a picture for yourself, what's the point? Because there'll be thousands and thousands of pictures out there that you could just get and buy or you know, put on your phone or whatever the heck you want to do. You don't really need to take your own picture of the thing.
Yeah, but you do, don't you? Because you want your perspective from wherever you are. That's the one thing about photography.
So I think you could, if you wanted to, I think you could take your, if you use the glasses, you could probably put them across your phone's lens and take that.
Oh, by the way, in terms of, you just made me think of something. I forgot to shout them out at the start of the show. Fan of the show, Carrie, and fan of the show, Jenny, both emailed me.
You haven't given them nicknames or anything.
No, we haven't. They're just fans of the show. Okay. They both emailed me to say how much they enjoyed hearing the jigsaw puzzle story again.
You're really going
to... No. I'm not milking that. But what I'm saying is, to the point of... To your point, because the whole point of that jigsaw puzzle thing was, why would you, you know, you
why do you make it?
Yeah. Anyway, what I'm saying is I do think people take photos because they want their very personal perspective of the event. But you are right. You're much better off downloading the National Geographic monster telescopic picture, but that doesn't honestly replicate where you were standing that day.
No, but the difference is so much smaller, right? Like, it's one thing to say, I want a personal perspective of the woods behind my house, yeah, rather than a picture of woods. But it's the sun. It's up there. Like, it's sky, sun.
You can't...
If the picture's taken by somebody else 10 miles away,
not really what you do is you anger yourself to take a selfie.
Right.
And that also... That would be... You're also protecting yourself because you're not looking at it anyway.
Yes, that would be more interesting.
So anyway, you got the eclipse coming up.
The thing is, though, you won't come out in the selfie because if you have to put the filter over it so it blocks everything, the sun, it'll just be all dark. Yeah. You won't even be able to see yourself in it.
All right. But anyway... the eclipse.
I wonder how many people are going to try to take selfies of themselves with the eclipse, and either
those guys are idiots.
Will be
people
so bright.
People who are going to do that
work,
morons.
It'll work where you're total eclipse, because they just like where if you go to some place where it's a full on true total eclipse, you don't need the glasses once it's a full total.
But it's only going to be for a couple of minutes, isn't it?
Right.
And then you get a bit of light back, and then like a the laser
beam. In fact,
it
says like there's something like as it's starting, there'll be like a little bit of a pattern. They say like that's you want to get your glasses back on at that point because it's about to get blinding again.
The emergency rooms are going to be packed that afternoon.
You know, they,
of people who have lost.
Some reason, the story was out of London. They said like the last time that happened. I mean, there were people who were injured. I mean, it wasn't like it killed you or something like that, but people had serious vision problems because they stared at this thing.
Well, like I say, this is if I'm an alien, this is the time to attack.
You just squint a lot.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. If I'm an alien, this is under cover of darkness.
Yeah, yeah.
You attack right now while everyone is squinting to look at the eclipse. So one, you already have your attention turned by the eclipse, and two, you can't see anything anyway.
I'm taking this total out of order, but it just made me think about attacks and things like that, which made me think of Dunkirk.
Yeah.
So the movie Dunkirk, you know, came out, and we previewed it.
We previewed it,
And we thought it was going to do pretty well, and I think we're right.
It's not. Why don't we talk Dunkirk now? Whatever.
I saw it.
You saw it on IMAX, didn't you?
Nope. Saw it in regular. I have it on my agenda to see on IMAX, but I want to see it in real IMAX.
IMAX.
There's IMAX, the commercial theater, and then there's IMAX at, like, the Smithsonian. And they're closing the IMAX at...
Yeah, I actually listened to
American History
the one
like
at
that.
The Natural History Museum. Yeah. I actually listened to
The Natural History one's staying open. Wait. Oh, you're right. Natural History is closing. Air and Space Downtown and Air and Space out in Udvar-Hazy is...
I listened to a local NPR show this week just during the day. It's the Kojo Nandi show that plays on 88.5 in the Washington, D.C. area. And they had on the chap from the National History Museum who was discussing the fact that the IMAX is closing, and he was lamenting it, and there was a half hour discussion about IMAX in general and also cinemas as a point of community. And I was driving around and I just kept yelling at the car radio that the National History IMAX is closing, because he was kind of putting the boot into the Air and Space IMAX.
Right.
But I'm like, the reason you're not getting any business, he's just showing all those nature shows, which is a fine segment of the audience.
Yeah.
Whereas more of us like to go and... If he was showing The Dark Knight, then they wouldn't have to go out of business.
Right. So...
Somehow it was awful.
Dunkirk was filmed in that. You can see it in a lot of different formats. I mean, even in the regular theaters, there's 70mm versus whatever. We did see it in 70mm, but... directed, this is repeating some of the things. Christopher Nolan, best known for all the Batman movies, Memento, The Prestige.
Inception, of course.
Inception, you know, so he's sort of like a... He's always written with a weird sort of twist to things, you know, and has his own take on things and visuals and all that. So brought a bunch of air. And Dunkirk is sort of an interesting movie. Most people give it very good reviews. A couple of, like, critics gave it, like, horribly bad reviews, just sort of saying... it's not like a classically plotted
there
movie.
Was no personal story, there was no the usual stuff. I mean, because I know you're gonna ask me, I was back in London when Dunkirk was released. I'd arrived that day, so I did
which
think
by the way, for people who don't know, Dunkirk is the story itself that's underlying this is the evacuation of the British and to a lesser extent French forces from Dunkirk,
getting out of town before the Germans took
France.
Over.
And this is the beginning of the war before America was in the war, when the first effort of military going in there, they lost. You know?
Yeah,
they got beat back, and so they had to get them out of there so that you didn't lose them all. They didn't all get killed or captured, so that you could then live to fight another day.
Yes, There was a couple of articles going on about, you know, is this an allegory for Brexit, yeah, and all sorts of stuff.
Well, that's what I was most interested, because I mean, here it's a story that we don't know generally. I mean, people know it, but I mean, it's not like a part of our regular world history lessons.
I did get a little irritated at reading a couple of stories at that, not because you cannot logically say it's an allegory for Brexit, but because someone clearly wants to discuss Brexit and wants to drag a movie into
it. It's a bad allegory for Brexit.
It's only an allegory for Brexit because you want to say it is. And what I mean by that is, I do not believe in any which way that Christopher Nolan's reinterpretation of Dunkirk at some moment is reflective of the fact that Britain are leaving the European Union. But if you want to make a statement either for or against the European Union, you then sort of get Dunkirk out of the drawer and go, see, this is what it is. And that's what irritated me.
Yeah, right.
And you'd ask me specifically if there was a little bit of...
I was just wondering whether, did that lead the British people to any level of introspection? Like, I mean, because it is, you know, World War II, people in America quickly forget, like, for Britain, it was an existential crisis. I mean, it was, this nation may not survive unless we figure out a way to fight back and we persevere through it all. Like, you know, all those shirts, the whatever, like, carry on. What's the right phrase?
Keep calm and carry on.
Carry on. Like, so now everybody's got a big joke. It's keep calm and buy more celery or, you know, whatever. Keep calm and whatever it is. Well, those things come from the notion of, like, listen, we're going to persevere through this trying time, bombing of London on a regular basis and living through it and taking shelter in tunnels and sending the kids off to the country so they aren't all killed and things like that. At this story, would the British people look at it and go, like, you know, look, that's us at our most heroic kind of thing. And what do we know? And I don't mean this.
I know what you're going to say. And these were the articles that I found most interesting, was the fact that people were using the release of Dunkirk to sort of question the notion that as a nation, are we continuing? We do seem to have, and rightly so, an ongoing fascination with what is basically our finest hour, Dunkirk turning, you know, turning defeat into victory, and then a couple of months later, the Battle of Britain.
Right.
Now, in reality, you know, and now people back in England are now yelling at their computers listening to me as, well, it's easy for him to say that because he doesn't live here anymore. There is this notion a little bit that we, as a nation, we continue. It's like when you go to England, all people, you know, there's this constant fascination with the fact that we won the World Cup in 1966. That was 51 years ago. Dunkirk is 80 years ago.
Yeah.
That's it for us. And so there are a lot of articles sort of questioning, you know, what moment are we going to move on and find new things to revel in? And, you know, that's what I'm saying. There was some narrative. Because, again, we always, you know, to talk about the English football team. Anytime England play Germany, there are always some people who show up dressed in RAF. Like, do you know what I mean? And with, like, they look like Spitfire pilots.
Yeah.
Because that's it for us.
Yeah.
And so there was the notion that, you know, not questioning Christopher Nolan's decision to make Dunkirk film.
Well,
but there was questioning, wow, is this it again that we're still banging on about something, about two world wars that are years ago, that current generations don't I mean, again, there's that moment in the film, there's a great moment in the film that, without getting too deeply into the film, it tells three different stories, basically. One on a small boat going to rescue soldiers, one a soldier trying to escape, and then some Spitfire pilots. And I sit there, now I wasn't born, I mean, I'm of indeterminate middle age. Mm-hmm. There's a moment when the Spitfires fly over the boat, and I think it's Mark Rylance's character turns to the others and goes, oh, you can't beat the roar of a Merlin engine.
Right.
And I sit there watching it going, yeah, Spitfires are the greatest thing in the world. And I feel myself shudder a little bit because that's ingrained in me.
Yeah.
Like, there you go. This is it. And I'm like, yeah, wow. If we just had Spitfires back, we'd be running the world. Do you know what I mean? There is this weird sort of thing. So I sat and watched it, and I'm like, yeah. And it is interesting how there are these sort of moments that do resonate in our culture. And some of the articles, instead of going on about Brexit, they were going on about the fact is, isn't it time we found other things that should be resonating with us rather than, and again, Spitfires went out of service 20 years before I was born. Yeah, I still think they're the most amazing thing in the world. And it's this weird sort of thing. To tell a story about this notion of time, and I was on holiday. I took the family, and we went to Kensington Palace, which was where Lady Diana lived.
Yeah, and then there's all these things.
And that's because it's been 20 years. And so one of the things they have in Kensington Palace is they have a display of the princess's dresses.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm standing there with a 16-year-old explaining to her who Princess Diana was, because, yeah, she was dead before this person was born.
Yeah.
And I was suddenly struck by the notion of, yet things that resonate, you know, it's like people was gone about where they were when Kennedy was shot.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, but I wasn't on Earth then. And so by extension, Dunkirk is 1940. And it's still this sort of feel-good moment. And so some of the articles that I read when I was back home when it was released was that there was this sort of general sense of, haven't we moved on? Why haven't we moved on? How can we move on without totally dismissing what was a purely, was, you know,
yeah,
a really heroic moment? So, well, it is interesting.
So the interesting thing about that is, like, well, in order to move on, you need to have more moments like that, right? Like, you can't, you can't, it's just not like, oh, well, you know, we're going to revel in our triumphant financial services sector. You know,
yeah, we've got a great
bank banking, you know, you need to have these moments. Now, it isn't to say that, I mean, you can't create those moments. Those moments are thrust upon you.
And Tony Blair did.
Right. But you can't create, but that's the thing, is that everybody needs to be ready to do those moments. Like, so I was just thinking to myself, okay, what moments do we have like that are of more recent vintage? And you could say September 11th is one, right? And yet, you know, when the history books are written to talk about the heroism of people associated with September 11th, it isn't going to be like that. It's not like a world war. You know, even that is relatively small. It's an amazingly unusual event that, you know, somebody could come over and bring down things in New York City and in Washington, D.C., but it isn't relative to the Battle of Britain or relative to the whole war, a full continent, multi-continental battle fight, and is not the same. And so, I mean, we shouldn't pine for the worst things to happen so we can get past the old worst things. That, I mean, I don't have any trouble with people looking back at the things that were done by the greatest generation, both sides of the Atlantic.
No,
you know. That's fine, because it was something that was done there. But you can't, I'm going around in circles here.
No, I know what you're saying.
You can't trash the modern world.
Exactly right.
Because if it doesn't have anything like this, well, you would have to have something that would happen to have like this. And would we, I'm not saying that we would necessarily succeed in reacting to something like that, but I do think it is, you could.
That, I mean, that said, towards the end of the movie Independence Day, President Bill Pullman stands there and bangs on the bullhorn, we're going to celebrate our Independence Day.
The planetary protection officer could be the next hero.
To your point, And this was, you know, we're talking about things to do with a movie that tries to tell a story about an event 70 years ago. And like I say, there were a couple of articles about Brexit, a couple of things I read about sort of, you know, Britain looking at its own past and where it stands.
Right?
Oh, yeah. And then there were a load of articles sort of trashing the movie that somehow it wasn't historically correct because it chose to feature certain things. And nothing drives me more mad, and I'm now going to rail perhaps against political correctness, which I don't mean to, because I do think I'm quite a politically correct person. You know, they didn't show it. He didn't show enough.
The big thing I saw is like,
he didn't show enough from the French. He didn't show enough women. He didn't show Nazis. He didn't show people of color.
Oh, you know, they never showed who the enemy was. I'm like, that's not the point.
But that's what I'm saying. He chose to tell a story. He chose to tell a story. It's not a documentary about Dunkirk.
Right.
So he didn't consciously go, I'm going to ignore that part of history. He chose to tell a story about Dunkirk. And he specifically said, I didn't want to show who the enemy was. Wasn't important.
You know what the problem is, though, with that, right? Is that,
Because
of the nature of the story, it is not a classic. It's not like Saving Private Ryan, where people would say, well, yeah, it's like this. Because of, you know, those first set of critics we were talking about complained that it didn't have a story.
Yes.
The real answer is it told a story in a way that's not the plain vanilla linear story of like the merry band going across and right. how they triumph individually. It was it had stories about individuals, but they almost had no name and no, they were representatives of a set. I mean, this is what Christopher Nolan does. He tells a story in a way that's a different way, you know, and that's what modern media can do.
I think what he tried to do was create a drama through a documentary like Lens.
Right, well, that's so like the people who wanted to be more documentary.
But that doesn't make it a bad documentary.
They look at it and they go, oh, look, it's, you know, it's done like a documentary. Why didn't it tell all the facts? Well, like, that doesn't have to.
He wasn't making a documentary.
I mean, I guess if art doesn't piss off people either direction, it's not really doing its job.
So I guess we need to come to the point. I mean, did you in...
Yeah, I thought it was great.
Did you... So let me ask you something, because I don't want to get too far down our ranking of the movie, but I remember my criticism, my concern about the film was it was telling an historical event that a large part of the world, meaning the US market, weren't familiar with. Through Saving Private Ryan talked about D-Day, everyone in the US, yeah, D-Day, our boys, bailing out Britain and Europe and, you know, the whole nine yards. My concern for the film was in markets that were not involved in Dunkirk, people aren't going to go and see it because they didn't know what it was. So with that in mind, obviously you know about Dunkirk, but if someone didn't know about Dunkirk and went to see it,
I think they'd
do you believe they'd still go, well, where were the Germans and blah, 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 blah? I mean, that was the thing.
I think they would, a modern viewer, a millennial,
Dunkirk,
or when they're Gen Z,
as Mark Ryland keeps calling it, Dunkirk. We're going to Dunkirk.
Yeah,
and it's still an accent.
I think they would enjoy it because it stands on its own, even if you didn't know. Even if you didn't know who was over that hill, it's, so what? That wasn't really the point. The point was, like, people acting heroically, people not acting heroically. You know, some people are not acting heroically, and like, all the little steps, and he arranges it in a certain way. There's...
So typically Christopher Nolan, he can't just tell the story, can he? He had to jazz it up a bit.
Like, nothing without time shifts.
You can't just tell a story.
Do pay attention. If you go watch it, do pay attention to the captions at the beginning, because that'll give you a clue as to
how things are working out. Yeah.
I mean, the one thing I thought, and I don't want to give anything away, was that there was a mishap that befell a participant that I thought was a little bit too convenient to create a drama off of. But it was minor. I also, like, at the time, you know, when you leave the movie and he does so much stuff with the music and the way it sounds. It's a Hans Zimmer soundtrack.
I thought the soundtrack was amazing.
But it's amazing. It was
completely immersive.
I could almost not see pictures.
Experience.
I could almost not see pictures, and it would elicit like this sort of anxiety.
Yeah.
So at some level you go, well, that's sort of manipulative. But I'm like, well, what's the point? I mean, that's what movies are, is like they get you to feel something about stuff that didn't really, well, in this case it did happen. But like the story itself was not a true story.
I do want to say this about the whole IMAX thing, where we sort of entered into this topic, is, you know, Christopher Nolan is known for filming in that format. All his films, with the exception of two of his earlier ones, Memento and then the one with Al Pacino where he's up all night in Alaska as the detective, they tend to be big canvas, spectacular, you know, they're very visual movie-going experiences. The one thing I liked about Dunkirk was, for me, some of the most memorable moments were actually just the small, quick visions of things rather than the huge set piece.
Yeah.
And I do think, you know, I do think, you know, for some of the criticisms that were thrown at the film for, you know, it didn't cover this, that, and the other, I remember walking out of it thinking, ooh, that may be his best. I like Memento an awful lot, his first movie,
mm-hmm.
Or his first mainstream Hollywood movie, because he did do a black and white one before that called Following, which again has time shifts and the same thing played over three different times. I felt it arguably was probably one of his most best work, is such a horrible thing to say, but I thought he really did a really good job in terms of, you know, as he said himself, I couldn't do what Spielberg had done. And what I'm saying is, just as a cinematic experience where you sit there and you're looking at a big screen and this music is going, I felt there was something very immersive about it.
Oh, yeah. It was very good. So we're topics-wise, let's see.
We might as well finish with some Ds. We've got the delivery and the driverless car. We're going back to some old stuff that we've gone.
Save the dreams for later, maybe. Let's see how we go through delivery and the driverless cars.
You sent me something about... I can't remember which article it was that was comparing, was it delivery services or was it specifically?
Yeah, it's about delivery services. So,
We have talked in the past about the little trucks that I've seen tested.
Yeah, the automated things. Yeah. But this is more like just the delivery system for food now, and talking about in DC. And these are bigger in the cities, but it's going to go everywhere eventually. And it's the food delivery systems where, like, they start off by talking about DoorDash, which is one of the delivery folks. I'll rattle off some of the many other companies that are in this space.
They basically start, for you to consumer, they start as an app on your phone. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one thing.
I think maybe something you can do with a computer, but basically it's on your phone and you go, okay, I want to have this food kind of thing. And so they start with like ice cream. You can get ice cream from DoorDash. Yeah. So it's got to get from Baskin Robbins to your house without melting.
Yeah.
And you pay for the product, you pay for some premium. There's usually tipping involved depending upon what the service is.
Not all of them. That was in the comparison, not all of them.
But this is, they're styling, I don't know where they get the stats from, a $43 billion system. There's so many players in this space now. Like, so I think we've mentioned before, Uber Eats.
Yes.
So Uber's got a system. I'm pulling up my phone because I download all the apps because I did think if we wanted to sometime, we could do an experiment. There's a couple of articles that where people tried to order things from everything at the same time and see how they show up. So you have Uber Eats is basically an extension of Uber car driving service where these folks bring you food. And so they're using their own independent drivers who then they'll put in the restaurant order. They go pick it up from the restaurant, bring it to you. It's not the restaurant. Amazon Prime have their Prime now. Like we talked about the grocery delivery, but part of that is restaurant delivery. Again, their drivers go get the food, bring it to your house kind of thing. DoorDash, is that the one I just mentioned already?
Yeah,
I can't remember if DoorDash uses. I think DoorDash uses.
No, Someone Go you mentioned.
There's Grubhub. Grubhub is has been around much longer, and it's probably the biggest one there. And I think they use a number of delivery, like the places can use their own delivery people, and it becomes more of an ordering system. Grubhub and
like takeout taxi.
Seamless Web was one that was really, it's really mostly in New York now, but it was that Seamless goes back, but Grubhub and Seamless are now the same company. Seamless was a big one at law firms and other businesses where you could order food after hours, like you're working late, and Seamless Web, it used to be called Seamless Web, now it's just called Seamless, because you would go on the website, you'd order the food, and the real reason they would do it that way is it was a way to automate the payments so that the company that you work for would pay for it and bill it through.
Yeah.
And you get the food to show up. You have Yelp now has a thing called Eat24, and they'll deliver the food to you just so you can go right on Yelp, go to reviews, and then find out you can get the food. Postmates is another one that delivers food.
Do you know what's the one where they have light blue boxes on their pedal bikes? Or is that only it? Maybe I'm getting confused with one in England.
I don't know.
I wish I'd done my research. All these
are, like, you notice, look at the icons are all red.
Yeah, just to fool you into using the other one. Probably. A mistake, yeah.
But, you know, I've used Uber Eats. I've used Amazon Prime. I may have used Grubhub in an older iteration. I haven't tried the other ones. I did notice, you know, we talked about doing a chicken thing. A bunch of them deliver chicken, and I was thinking maybe we should just have all the chicken delivered from these different places.
And then that's two shows that we've wasted on one show. We should do a delivery show, and then we can go out and
just solves us the time of having to drive from.
Because we will be doing our one of our annual taste test shows shortly.
My office neighbor is like hates like fast food, and so when I said we were maybe going to go around to all the chicken places,
she was like, looking forward to this one this year, man. I'm looking forward to it. We've done coffee, we've done burgers, doing chicken. Do you use these things? I see them on your
phone.
Just
those two, and I'm planning to try the other ones out just to see what it's all about.
Because obviously I'm now going to rail against them. I don't quite get it. No, I do get it. I understand that for people in our busy lives just want to have one thing and have it all done for them.
Yeah.
For me, part of eating is deciding what you want, and then if you're having it delivered, looking at the menu.
We can still do that.
Yeah, but I don't. I mean, do all these places? That's interesting. As you said yourself, on some of these ones, they're using the restaurant's delivery. Some of them are using their own drivers. Some of them are using the restaurant's drivers. Well, just call the restaurant yourself.
Well, yeah, but that's why I use OpenTable for making restaurant reservations. When you can press things on your phone. People say it all the time.
I use OpenTable.
Yeah, it's just I don't have to talk to somebody. I don't have to be like, oh, can you hold? No, have a discussion with them. Okay. I can see the little buttons I press. I can see the exact price that comes up at the time. I don't have to have a piece of paper in that drawer that you have all the menus in.
I can't remember in the article because they also evaluated what the surcharge was. Yeah, because they evaluated what the surcharge was, and they also evaluated whether you had to tip or where you didn't have to tip. Yeah. But I'm trying to figure out where, you know, where is one financially at the end of the day, how much over the
I mean, what's weird paying? About it, right, is these are regular restaurants. Some of them are regular restaurants, yeah. not just takeout places. And you end up paying more than you would in the regular restaurant because they're charging you the regular price they would to get a burger and have it served in the restaurant. Exactly. But then you're charging another $5 to have it brought to you. And you know, at the level of having getting meals for two people, you know, it's you're adding up there. And so suddenly your meal for two people from a mid-level type food place is suddenly costing $30 or $40 or something like that.
I mean, I do get the convenience aspect of it. I really do. Much, I mean, I sort of make fun of it at a certain level because for me, part of the experience is, ooh, let me look at the menu from, you know, Shanghai Bay and what do I want?
Yeah, some will be tying into Google and home and all that stuff. You can just be like, get me this thing.
I will say this. I will not. If I start downloading these apps and using them, I will not miss.
Delivers now.
I will not miss calling up a restaurant and they're going, what's the name? And going, Zeph. And then the person going, Jeff. Or there's just a silence because I haven't heard.
What's your address?
What's your address? And then what's your name? And I'm like, just sitting like, my name is Dave. Oh, Dave. Yeah.
It's a lot easier.
Yeah, it's a lot easier. So I won't miss that the impersonality of it is something.
So some of those outfits are working heavily with the restaurants to figure out the delivery stuff because a lot of food doesn't delivery super well. Like French fries, there's a big part about French fries.
That's the thing.
The problem
is
that French fries, by the time they get to you, lose their crispness.
Yeah.
So like a bunch of them work with them and try to convince the restaurants, like, listen, you don't want to put your French fries in a styrofoam clamshell. You put it in a cup so it's open. And as long as we keep it warm, it won't end up being super mushy by the time it gets there, kind of thing. So, it's not going away. But the thing is, there's so many companies. There's no way this minute number
they're
of
not
companies
survive,
are they? Right? So,
let me tell you.
Interesting to see who's is the most successful one going to be the one that has the head start, like a Grubhub, or is the most Grubhub, or is it going to be the one that is actually best?
Well, to get to our last article,
probably not the best. The best never wins.
We're going to head to our. I suspect this will be our last topic. The one that will be survive will be the one that goes with driverless.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's the other point. All these people are like waiting for the driverless.
We do have to. We have a driverless story that we want to talk about.
This is a particular story. Okay.
Well. Because I did find a story that from the London Evening Standard, so shouting out a different paper, a segment of London is shortly experimenting with driverless grocery delivery. It won't come to your house. There's an area in London called, it's in Woolwich, which is just south of the river.
The delivery, rather.
It's in, well, yeah, what will happen is groceries will be delivered to a... They won't come to your door, but they will come to a standard pickup place where you can go and...
Like, that must be a problem with London itself, because London's
it was a bit vague in terms of why that's the way they were doing it, but the point of the article was they would be employing... they were shortly going to begin testing driverless delivery vehicles, but during the testing period, they would have a human in the vehicle... Mm-hmm. To monitor in case anything goes wrong.
They don't have driverless cars in London.
Not
like
yet.
Just a regular, like
cab. No, not yet. But I guess they're intending to get there. And so this did lead to our last story.
Yeah, so this is an actual event that was going on in Arlington, Virginia. A bunch of people started posting on Arl Now as a local blog.
Yeah, on their Twitter
news
and Instagram.
Which is actually a very good news blog site. But people are like... There's a car driving around with nobody in it. Like, there's no driver in this car. Yeah. And there was even a story there. I never saw a confirmation that it had gone through a red light. That, like, that's what started, like, people being like, this is driverless car.
It was like a standard, it was like a white van or
minivan
panel van.
Type thing.
So, is a nondescript vehicle. It wasn't like a Ferrari that didn't have a driver in it.
So,
it
there's this driverless car, you know. And so people were out there clearly looking for the driverless car, including, like, local news people. And it was going back and forth through a very busy area of Arlington. And when somebody got to it, they figured out it wasn't actually driverless. That there was a person in the car, but they were dressed up like a seat.
Yes.
Like, so, like, there's a picture. There's a person.
You can see a picture.
Like, the reporter was trying to get the person to start to pay attention, but, like, they wouldn't answer the knock on the window, so to speak. I mean, the car was sitting there, and the person was knocking on the window, and the person's not there. So, at first, I saw this. I'm like, that is so weird. Why would you? And you looked at it, and it's like the picture, the seat is like two-tone.
Yes.
And you can kind of see the person's hand sticking out from where like the hinge of the seat would be, but like they're otherwise they're like behind the fabric of the flat seat kind of thing.
It was very good, actually.
Why would you do that, right? You know, and at first I thought, well, maybe this is about the automated system in there dealing with not having a person in there or something like that. But it turns out that's not what it is. I don't know if you read far enough to figure out why they were doing this.
They were testing how people would react.
Exactly, right.
Yeah, so, rather than just pranking. When I originally saw the article, at first I thought, before I started reading, I thought it was some prankster.
Right.
But then...
So what they're trying to figure out is, because the car is designed to recognize when people would be in a crosswalk and stop for them and the like. In addition to this thing, it had some white lights up at the top of the windshield that faced out. And so they would like blink in different patterns depending upon whether somebody was there or not. And the reason they were doing this is because they said, you know, when people are walking around on the streets, you know, in a busy neighborhood, they make eye contact drivers. You know, you see a driver coming up to a thing, you can tell, are they going to stop? Are they not going to stop? You know, the driver gives you a little nod or something like that. All these very subtle cues. I mean, the driver could actually just wave you out. But a lot of times it's just subtle elements of, okay, I see you kind of thing. Well, when there's no driver, you don't really know if that car sees you or what it is. And so they were trying to have this go around where people wouldn't realize there was a person in the car who was there for safety purposes. And instead, like, I can't remember, like the light on top would blink when it was sort of acknowledging you were there. Like it would go back and forth, or it would stay solid, or it would do different things to sort of create a nonverbal acknowledgement that you were there. And this is all part of their like testing the car. I don't know if it ever said who it was, was it a Google car or what it was.
But, see, I do think ultimately, you know, this story and this incident does lead me to believe that I think this is going to be the biggest challenge. And I think we've said this before when we've discussed this. Clearly, driverless technology is here in terms of creating cars that can do their own thing. Again, in London, they're going to have driverless delivery. They will put a human in there, but that is as much to appease everyone else as it is to, you know, to work the car. I think ultimately the challenge is going to be, how do we interact with it? Because again, I ride my bike and I ride my bike on the road. And just talking right now, I'm thinking, yeah, there are a lot of moments when I get to the stop sign or I know I'm next to a driver and I'm like, dude, do you see me type thing? Exactly. Or when I ride along in the city, I'm trained to look ahead for seeing the face of someone in a mirror.
Yeah.
Like, oh, is that dude about to open his door or is he pulling out? The minute you remove that very personal interaction, communication just goes right out the window.
Yeah.
And that is, I understand they're testing. I don't know what they've come up with, but I think we're a couple of generations away from people going, oh, the light is blinking twice.
So, I mean,
that means it's good. Yeah, I don't trust that dude.
Exactly. No, you won't. I mean,
frankly, it's really. How am I to know that the vehicle's not been taken over by aliens? And in fact, that's what I'm going to be looking for.
I mean, and the thing is, for a person, you know that people are motivated by guilt or fear. Like, you know, when they make eye contact, you know they're not going to run into you because most people aren't psychopaths. You know, they're just going to like, they're going to basically be like, well, I don't want to run into that person. But you don't know if a machine doesn't have a conscience or anything like that. I'm not saying it would act nefariously, but it doesn't care. Like, other than its programming saying I should stay here, it's not like you can rely on an overriding sense of ethics or something like that from the machine.
Maximum overdrive, baby. They all go out of control.
Exactly.
With Emilio Estevez, of all people, who's always been the nicest of the machines.
Yeah, I mean, like, just think about like all the terrorist attacks now that are pointed around cars just driving into people.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's with people. That's with psychopaths, people, you know, like behind the wheel. Well, now if you could just hack into one of these things and say, okay, just drive into those, make your white lights blink, and then just run everybody over.
So, yeah, I mean, obviously the technology's here. We talked about that. I mean, again, you know, which of those delivery services is going to survive?
Yeah.
It's going to be the one that dumps its labor cost as quickly as it can.
Yeah, right.
Right? That's what it is. I'm not paying the driver. I don't have to tip anyone. The machine just comes to the door.
It's funny they're starting, I think about it, they're starting all this automated driving in cities, which I know, but that's the hardest thing, right? Like if you were in a two-stoplight town, isn't that where the automated car should start its deliveries from the pizza place and things? You know, like why do it in London where like you have so much hard stuff to deal with? Why not try the automated car someplace where there's only 10,000 people.
Well, it's funny. I didn't send you this article, but when I was in England, there was a couple of articles about the fact that a number of airlines have now said that the technology exists to safely have pilotless planes, but they're not at the point.
Nobody's going to get it.
Yeah, everyone's like, yeah, we're just the issue is convincing passengers that it's fine. Yeah. But they're like, the technology, yeah, we don't need it's here.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the thing. But to your point, and I'd read somewhere else, I can't remember if I'm getting. I think it's Tesla, which is a story that we're not going to have time to get to, but we will come back to that one, Elon Musk's company. I think Tesla are getting into building electric big trucks,
delivery trucks. Oh, that makes sense, yeah.
And apparently the notion is to get two big trucks that could do the long distances without a lot of stops that wouldn't need a driver, basically connecting two stoplight towns.
Yeah.
It's all right.
Trains. I mean, trains ought to be able to run by things.
Well, they do.
And they are.
No, they do. I mean, the driver is. I can't remember which subway system it is in the world, and it might even be the London Underground. All the driver does is open and shut the doors. Driver doesn't have to. Once the doors have shut, the system kicks in and the train leaves the station. Like I don't know if it's. Some countries have it. Where, yeah, the driver actually is just, the driver doesn't drive, the driver is the conductor.
Yeah.
Whereas back in the day, you had the driver and then you had the conductor at the back who was pressing the buttons to open and shut the doors. So there you go.
Yeah.
All right, so we threw everything.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
We had some more, but we got leftovers there.
Well, we'll come back
to that. If you listen to this on double speed, it was only a half an hour long, so there.
Although, if you're NASA, hey, double speed. But again, my resume is strong.
Yeah.
At any speed. This has been The Atlantic Voice. I'm Zeph.
I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on The Atlantic Voice podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at atlanticvoice.net. Email us at atlanticvoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for The Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.